Tango Tango Papa 2101, January 13, 2022.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. So, I have been back at work, I guess, a little over a week at this point. So, one of the maintenance services, we have an A service and a B service. A B service is an oil change. This is on the truck. A service is, they're doing the oil changes, or the B service, that's every 75,000 miles, and then the A service, they do that every 25,000 miles, and they sort of grease things and, you know, kind of look things over really well, check things over, and there may be some other things that they do that's not the oil change. But so in any case, the A service was due, and so I stopped at the company terminal here in, you know, it's close to it's kind of in between Carlisle and, you know, kind of Mechanicsburg, New Kingston, Harrisburg, what have you. It's in the Harrisburg area, basically. So I stopped here. I actually got here last night and immediately I checked in with them. I guess it was probably about maybe 7:30, something like that. And so I arrived here, and he immediately said, well, you know, I told him what I needed, and he said, or he would put me up in a motel room, which that kind of surprised me, because typically I would expect them to not get to it, and because yesterday being Wednesday, I figured, you know, I got there in the evening, I figured that it would be at least Thursday morning before they got to it, but actually they were going to get to it last night. I guess the shop now is open till 2 a.m. It's open from 6 a.m. to 2 a.m. So anyway, I had to kind of scramble around and get some stuff so that I, you know, and then they called the shuttle van. They took me to a motel, or to the hotel, motel, whatever that they use. It's a Quality Inn, and it's, you know, just a few miles up the road, and so spent the night in the hotel, and then so then this morning rode the shuttle back. And so in the meantime, they had me set up to pick up, since I was available, I agreed to go to down in, I guess it was Yorkville, Pennsylvania, which is about, it's another town in the Harrisburg area. It's about 20 something miles from here, near Yorkville. But anyway, south of Harrisburg. So I went to a truck dealership and picked up a truck that had been worked on down there, and it was ready to be picked up. And so I went, and so they hired this Uber to come and get me, you know, this you know, and I don't know if this guy, if, you know, he was from the Middle East somewhere. I don't think he was from India. I'm not sure exactly where he was from. But I think he was more, you know, I don't think he was in, you know, I don't believe he was from India. But in any case, the thing I remember, you know, most about it, that, you know, he seemed like a nice guy and everything, but he drove crazy. You know, so about half of the trip, I just kept my eyes closed. Because he was, I don't know, he liked to follow too close. And, boy, he really got into his brakes hard all the time as well. And it's kind of aggressive. But so I, you know, some people would say something, but I figured that, you know, he... you know, would probably be okay. And so he was. So I got, he got me to the truck dealership down there. And so that was that. And then so I picked that up and then brought it back. And so then it was like 1:30. When I got back here, it was like 1:30 in the afternoon. So then I went and got something to eat. And then after that, then they dispatched me on a load that was actually already here at the yard. It was already dropped at the yard, so I'll pick that. I'm hooked on to that. That delivers tomorrow at 4 p.m. in Fredericksburg, Maryland, which is about roughly 160 miles from here. But since it's south of Washington, D.C., I'll leave early. You know, I'll probably leave here maybe by around 11 a.m. Eastern time, try to leave, and then that way, you know, I should be able to avoid most of the traffic. But if I can't, then I, you know, then I'll just be, you know, I'll have some margin for error, because you never really know going, because I will have to go around Washington, D.C., and you just never really know about that, you know, because I looked at it earlier today. And it wasn't even, you know, when I looked at the map, it wasn't even rush hour, and there was just all kinds of traffic jams, you know, in the Washington area. So, you know, the way I would have to go to get to here, to Fredericksburg. So I'll, like I say, I'll try to leave here by about 11, and then it should be about a 3-hour trip. But, you know, I'll allow some extra time for, you know, some, just in case. So then after that, after I deliver that load tomorrow afternoon, then I'm pre-planned on another load that picks up in, it also picks up in Virginia, Stewart's Draft, Virginia, and then that goes to Ogden, Utah, which I don't particularly care to go to Utah in January, but, oh well. You know, that's, it happens. So... in any case, I'm back in the truck, I'm just kind of hanging out here at the company terminal, and so I figured I'd just go ahead and record a podcast while I had the, you know, kind of had the extra time to do it. So I was watching this documentary. It was a documentary on YouTube, and it's the name of the documentary is actually Childhood 2.0. And what it's, the documentary, the focus of the documentary is social media and how kids, basically, it's not just, you know, teenagers, but kids are using social media at younger and younger ages. You know, the kids all have their cell phones, especially teenagers. And, you know, at this point, they pretty much have to have a cell phone, because then the schools are taking advantage of it. They're giving their lessons on, you know, through the social media and what have you. And so there's a major problem happening. And it's a problem that I talk about, I've talked about for years. You know, but it's worse than ever online, and it's even worse with children because they don't know any better. Now, what is the problem, you ask? Well, for years, if you've listened to me, you know, you can go back all, you know, as far back as you can. I've been telling people, you know, and I use the example, let's say somebody gives you a compliment, you know, they, oh, I like your shoes, or I like your shirt, or I like your car, or whatever it is. You know, and they're giving you a compliment, and then the wrong side of your ego imbibes it. You get it, you know, the wrong side of your ego gets this little charge out of it, like it, you know, you feel great. You're getting a big dopamine hit because, and you're in control of the dopamine hit, by the way. You know, you're not at the mercy of other people's words. If you don't, you know, it's your choice, really. But you make a mistake if someone gives me a compliment. I do the polite thing. I say thank you, but I do not. I've learned the lesson. I do not let the compliment go to my head. I do not let it stroke the wrong side of my ego. And by learning to never allow that to happen, then if the compliment doesn't come, or if somebody actually does the reverse and tells me, you know, like, your shoes look like shit, pardon the French, it doesn't bother me because I didn't get the emotional dopamine hit charge out of it in the first place. You know, if you imbibe a compliment, you know, if you eat out of the trough of other people's approval, then they manipulate you. They have control over you. And then if they suddenly withhold the compliments or do the opposite and tell you that, you know, you were expecting a compliment, and then they tell you something really negative, then it's like you've had the rug jerked out from under you. And you have, because it's the wrong side of your ego. It's like, you know, building your house on sand. The structure of your mind is built on sand. So translate that, and I'm just talking about the real world, translate that into social media. So these kids, adults do it too, but they put their little post online, and then they're checking to see how many people liked it. How many likes did they get? You know, let's say it's Facebook, and how many likes did I get? Oh my God, I didn't get enough likes. And that, so they're talking extensively about this in this Childhood 2.0 documentary that I watched earlier. And there's a lot of kids now that are young kids that are committing suicide. They're becoming depressed enough committing suicide at this point. So, you know, that when I talk about not learning not to imbibe a compliment, the potential, you may think, oh, well, I'll do it anyway. It's kind of like people eat sugar. Oh, I'll do it anyway. I've gotten away with it so far, I'll keep doing it. It's potentially deadly. Because what's happening, the kids don't get, you know, some kids are going to be more popular than others. It's based on what they look like, and often. And, but, you know, it's kids. Kids are terrible to each other. They were terrible whenever I was in school. You know, and now it's just that much worse because the communication's that much better. And so they, you know, they don't get the likes, and then all of a sudden they decide, you know, they become depressed because, well, they're not getting the likes. Or somebody's actually bullying them, or they're telling them that they're terrible. And they actually become depressed enough because they're resenting, you know, of course resentment's all mixed in there as well. Resent the fact that, you know, whatever, that they're not getting the likes, or that they don't look better, or whatever it is. And it gets to the point where they're suicidal. So it's, you know, taking a compliment the wrong way is very dangerous. And it's also, if you learning to do to take a compliment the right way, that is to say, don't get an ego boost out of it. You have to learn what that means yourself. I can kind of talk around it, but it's kind of like resentment. I can kind of talk around it, but you have to figure it out for yourself what it actually is. If you can really learn not to get not to get the ego charge out of compliment, you know, dealing with other people, then you've got the key to, you know, I'm going to call it happiness, but happiness is not an emotion. Happiness is, you can almost think of it as kind of like health. You don't realize that you're healthy until it's missing. You don't realize that you have health until there's something drastic, something goes wrong, and you realize, oh my God, now I want to get back to health. Well, health was something you didn't realize you had. Well, happiness is basically the same thing. It's not, you know, some emotional high. You know, that's not it. It's the absence. You can think of it really as the sort of the absence of misery. But you don't want the high. You don't want to feel good about whatever it is. You know, and it could be anything. You can do it with food. People do it with food. Somehow the ice cream makes them feel. Why do they eat the ice cream? Why, it makes me feel good. It makes my ego feel good. Why are people addicted to sugar? Why are people addicted to cocaine? Etc. 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 So it's a dangerous thing, and of course the kids, you know, they're kind of ignorant, and then the parents are ignorant, and you know, and it's going to end up being survival of the fittest, and the fittest are going to figure out somehow, they're going to figure out one way or another that don't imbibe the compliments. That's the big mistake. Don't imbibe the compliments. Don't get the ego charge out of somebody liking your post. Those are the ones that are going to survive, and the ones, you know, the least survivable are the ones that are going to end up committing suicide. Then you're going to have a bunch of them, you know, kind of the mediocre ones in the middle that may survive, but don't, you know, they don't emerge unscathed. So it's really, you know, an insidious thing. You know, there's nothing new about what's going on, you know, in this movie. They're sort of thinking, well, this is new because it's, you know, we didn't have social media before, but it amps things up. It's just, you know, the one thing that always improves with is knowledge, and with that, technical knowledge, technology. So the one thing that really always improves is communications. And that's good. It can be great, and it can also be terrible. But the dynamics are all the same. These dynamics of, you know, imbibing a compliment the wrong way have been present ever since there's been human beings. So, you know, all of the things that are important to human beings revolve around perception. You know, our perceptual function and dysfunction often define our existence. So, anyway, I have I'm kind of embarrassed to say this. I got to looking through my email back in, you know, because periodically, you know, I've got this tom@truckerphoto.com, and I've had it set up in the past. I've had it set up to go to Gmail so that, you know, Gmail checks that. That's one of the email addresses that Gmail checks, and then it, if it's working right, it'll pop up, you know, if I get an email and it'll to tom@truckerphoto.com, it will actually come into the Gmail. And so I periodically, this, you know, I'll check it and it seems like it's working, and then all of a sudden it's not working. And so I got to looking at it the other day, got it working again, and then I got to searching, and I found someone had sent me a voice file back in, it would have been April 6th of 2020. So that's, well, we're YouTube, like a year and 8 months ago. And it was from Mike. And so I'm going to go ahead and play that. And he's asking kind of a simple question. So here is Mike.
Hey, Tom. I hope all is well. Thanks for all you do out there. I've been listening for many years. Don't call in a whole lot with comments or questions, but I had one this time. I listened to your recent podcast, and you had asked, why are we here? Why do we exist? What are we meant to do here in this life of ours? And you kind of stumped me on that. I'm not sure really what you're getting at. I think I'm here because God placed me here, and I have a purpose. And when you asked that question, I had to think deep about it. And I think the reason I'm here is to raise the children that I've raised and to be a good companion to the wife that I have, and now be a big part of my grandchildren's lives and hopefully instill upon them good values and what I think is the right way to live and to respect others and just to be a good human being in general. But outside of that, I can't really think of why I'm here and what I'm supposed to do. I do feel like sometimes that I have a higher calling and I'm meant to do more. For years I was a firefighter, and I think in my life that's probably been one of the things that I can refer to the most, that I made a valuable contribution to the society that we live in. But outside of that, I spent a lot of time in business and sitting behind a desk and doing things that weren't very productive for the human race, other than just creating a paycheck for myself and providing for my family, which is important. But when you ask, what are we here for? All that I can really think is just to bring up the younger members of my family and make sure that they're off in a good direction before I depart. So I didn't know if that's, is that what you're getting at, and that's what you're referring to, and is that what we should be thinking about? I was a little confused. I'd like to hear what you think we're here for. Anyway, always nice to hear from you, and thanks for doing what you do. And we'll look forward to hearing your next podcast. Take care, Tom.
Okay, well, thank you, Mike. And I've already emailed Mike, and he answered, actually, telling him, you know, and apologizing for missing that for a year and 8 months. But it was still in there, and I was able to, you know, the file that he sent along was still attached, and I was able to get it out of the email and the whole bit. So, anyway, why are we here? Why do we exist? And, you know, everything that Mike mentioned, I agree with, as far as, you know, he's got kids and grandkids and, you know, kind of teaching them to relate to the world in the right way. But, you know, I also think it's important, you know, at least for me personally, I'm constantly sort of beset with that question. Why do I exist? I've always had that question for as long as I could remember. I've had that question, and of course, there's various answers to it. But and I think it kind of goes back to what I was just talking about. Our existence. You know, you can say, well, we exist physically, and we have to eat, and you know, sleep. And defecate, etc., etc. And yeah, we have to do that. But, you know, because we do have these physical bodies, but at the same time, we're also aware of our own existence. At the same time, we're also thinking about the difference between right and wrong. What is right? What is wrong? So our existence really does end up revolving around, to a large extent, perception. Our perception of reality. What is, you know, what is real? What is relevant? What's important? And it's really not a one-size-fits-all. Because I think each one of us can end up with some, you know, and should end up with some unique answers. Now, of course, there's going to be a great deal of commonality. But I think it's important to, you don't just ask the, you know, why do I exist kind of question. I've just never asked it once or thought about the answer once. And there's, you know, there can be a variety of answers. And you can kind of examine the question and the answers from a, you know, an infinite number of angles. But I think it's an important question it certainly is for me. An important question that I keep asking myself. And it's not something that I don't have to actively ask myself this. It just naturally has, you know, it's always naturally been with me. Probably, you know, virtually every moment of my existence, that question is kind of there in the background. And like I say, it has many answers, and the answers that Mike gave are quite valid. But I think at the same time, another, you know, the kind of the answer that comes to my mind is, it's going to be hard to put into words. I think in part we're here to be aware, because we're created with this awareness. That's a fundamental thing, that, you know, it's a fundamental property of being a human being, is being aware of our own existence. Since that's such a fundamental element, or a component of being a human being is this awareness of our own existence, then I think it behooves us to not try to distract ourselves from it, but to really embrace it. And I think that it by, you know, considering this question, why do I exist? You know, why am I here? Why do I exist? Why am I aware? We're actually interacting with whatever force brought us into existence and sustains that existence. So, you know, we're actually interacting with that as we, you know, really seriously consider the question. You know, so, and it's kind of a spiritual question. You know, it's not for, you know, people that, you know, want to take things literally and just kind of act flippantly. It's a fundamental question. And I think fundamentally, if you really ask the question on at a really fundamental level, you can actually realize there is a God, there is a creator. And it's not just some sort of woo-woo, hocus-pocus thing that you're fooling yourself into. And, you know, pity the people that can't do that, that are cut off from that, because they're missing out. And there's not a whole lot extra that can be said about it. But I do think that, you know, just to kind of repeat myself and sum it up, asking, you know, if you have that question, why do I exist? Why am I here? If you can't kind of force that question. But like I say, I've had it my entire life, and it's sort of driven me in large part. That question has kind of been a driving force for my entire existence, and so therefore that's sort of driven me into interacting with my creator. And that may be one of the differences. You know, I've often said, well, I don't know, you know, what's the difference? Why do some people ask that question, and some people don't really seem to care? They're just happy sitting and watching Netflix, and, you know, as the time passes. And I think, you know, but, you know, that's probably the difference. Some people have this question. I've had this question my entire life, and it's nothing that I did. It was just I had the question. Why am I here? Why do I exist? That type of question has been with me my entire existence. And there are probably, you know, there are other people that the question, you know, they don't have it, or they're scared by the question. And, you know, but it still begs the question, you know, why do some people have that, you know, why do people, some people have that question and some people don't? So, but it's, really a fundamental, you know, awareness is a fundamental part of being a human being. And, you know, how we perceive the world. Do we perceive the world properly? Because then if you ask these questions, you know, why do I exist? Why am I here? If you're serious about that, then sort of implicit within that, you're going to be also kind of digging into, you know, like epistemology. You know, how do you know what you know? You know, and it sort of drives all sorts of philosophical questions. And if you're really serious about it, you kind of get outside, you know, you sort of don't accept just the pad answers, and you sort of ends up driving you to get completely outside the box. But I can tell you it's a wonderful question to be obsessed with. So, anyway, I also received a voice file from Joel. It's kind of an 8-minute voice file, and he was talking about the vaccine and what have you. But something went really wrong. I don't know if it was, you know, maybe it was a Bluetooth headset, but and then the noise cancellation that was working with Voxer. And it is really, you know, just super difficult to listen to. And so I'm not going to play it. And I've already told Joel, you know, I answered him back and I told him that it was kind of cutting in and out pretty badly, but I was able to kind of listen through it and kind of determined he was talking, you know, basically kind of talking about the vaccine and why, you know, why would you get it and what have you. And, you know, and he mentioned this latest version of the virus and, you know, virtually no one's dying from it. So I don't know. I think that people aren't taking any. If you've turned the news off, if you've taken my advice and you've shut the propaganda off, because it's not news anymore, it's just propaganda, just turn it off. And I think a lot of people already have turned it off. And you know, I see quite a, you know, like I'm in Pennsylvania right now, and they've got, you know, of course my company's put up signs, and it says and I've seen them in other businesses as well, that, well, if you've got the vaccine, then you don't have to wear a mask. But if you're unvaccinated, you're supposed to wear a mask. Well, you know, and in a lot of cases, it'll say you have to wear a mask anyway. Well, virtually no one is wearing a mask. You see a few of them, but most people aren't. You know, so people aren't. I think a lot of people aren't taking that seriously anymore because they realize it's propaganda. You know, so I've gotten to the point where a lot of the stuff that they talk about, I don't even, you know, I don't believe any of it anymore. You know, and I'm not even going to listen to it. Don't care about it. It's not the real world. They're trying to create a perception. Human beings are all about perception. We end up acting on the things that we believe. And you got to be careful about what you believe. How do you know what you know? Epistemology. How do you know what you know? Kind of goes back to, why do I exist? What's the purpose? What's the purpose of existence? What's the purpose of awareness? You why are we where? There has to be a purpose to it. What is the purpose? Purpose is to interact with their creator in the correct way, in the moment, sort of real time, one moment to the next, to the next. So, the other thing I was going to do, I've got, it's about, probably 30 minutes or so, maybe a little longer. I haven't done this for a long time, but I've got this, it's audio to a video that I got off of YouTube. And it's the guy that's giving, he's giving this presentation, and it's probably about 30 minutes long. And the guy's name is Dr. Gary Fitke, and he's talking the title of his presentation is The Dose is the Poison, and it's talking about carbohydrates, and he does it in a very matter-of-fact way, and I found it quite good to listen to, because it kind of hits all the points, and it does it in a very concise way. And so I think that if you can, I found it extremely interesting, and so hopefully you will too. But I think everybody should be at least exposed to this information. You may not want to believe it, but I think it's useful to be exposed to it. And at least at that point, if you've been exposed to the information, then you at least have, you know, you've been exposed to it, and you have the chance to, you know, either believe it or not. So anyway, so here's the audio to that. This, again, this is Dr. Gary Fitke, and the name of the presentation is The Dose is the Poison.
Dr. Gary Fitke here from Tasmania, a long way away from a lot of you, and it's good to catch up with you, albeit in this format. Obviously, I've had a fascination for the topic of sugar and carbohydrate for a long time now, and it's great to see that there is a growing awareness of the damage done by excessive carbohydrate intake. But one of the things which has interested me is how much is too much, and what alternatives do we have? So it may surprise you to see that anything more than one teaspoon is treated by the body as being toxic. It all comes down to biochemistry. So we managed to evolve over 2.5 million years and get to the top of the food chain as hunter-gatherers. And we were eating, obviously, fresh, local, seasonal food, which by definition was low in carbohydrates and higher in healthy fats and protein. Our carbohydrate intake was primarily seasonal from fruit, and certainly not all year round in the amounts that we see today. Carbohydrate availability was uncommon in nature when we were hunter-gatherers. Around 10,000 years ago, we had the onset of the agricultural revolution, the development of cropping and farming practices. And since then, our general health has deteriorated. The last century has seen an abundance of refined carbohydrate and processed food, and with that, our health has exponentially declined. So I have no commercial conflicts of interest to declare, but I do want you off sugar, and I am a long-term advocate for a low-carb, healthy-fat lifestyle. We should define carbohydrate. Carbohydrate is either glucose or fructose, or found in combinations. Both are different organizations of the same molecular structure, combinations of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. Complex carbohydrates are just longer chains of glucose and fructose combined together, and then broken down to the simple structures in the digestive process. Carbohydrates are unique in that we have biochemical pathways for them, even though we have no requirement to actually eat them in the first place. When carbohydrate is not available in the diet, the body will produce just enough for its requirements. When it has an excessive amount, the human body goes to great lengths to remove it from the bloodstream. I repeat, the human body goes to great lengths to remove it. We do not have a safe transport mechanism for carbohydrate in the blood, and its presence has toxicity, particularly in the amounts commonly eaten today. The interesting issue is how rapidly the body removes these molecules from the bloodstream. Glucose and fructose are not transported well in the blood, and they are generally dissolved in it. Both are rapidly absorbed from the gut, and the body's metabolism does everything in its capacity to remove them from the bloodstream as quickly as possible. Our metabolic pathways go to great length to stop an elevation in the blood glucose and via separate pathways in the liver to metabolize and remove fructose from the bloodstream. The human body does not like leaving glucose nor fructose in the blood. So why are they removed so actively? Just maybe glucose and fructose in excess are toxic. By contrast, the body maintains a safe and efficient mechanism of transporting protein and fat in the bloodstream in the form of lipoproteins. Those lipoproteins vary in size, density, and proportion of protein to fat and are known by their particle names. Lipoproteins safely move fat and protein around the body. We don't have a safe and efficient method of transporting excess glucose, apart from it being dissolved in the blood. Therefore, I'll argue that anything beyond a normal blood glucose becomes the problem. So clearly, too much carbohydrate is harmful. But could that dosage be as small as 1 teaspoon? The bloodstream can only manage 1 teaspoon of around 4 grams of glucose at a time. And excess provokes a physiological response which is harmful to the body. And then we have fructose with its own unique metabolic properties which can be harmful. So let's define toxicity. Toxicity of most substances is dose related. With carbohydrate, it is the excess beyond requirements. And when that excess has a negative effect on the system. So we're going to cover a few topics. How does the body handle carbohydrate normally? What are the differences between glucose and fructose metabolism and their harmful effects? The circulating level of glucose in the bloodstream is about 5 millimoles per litre or 9 milligrams per deciliter. That is around 4 grams, which is approximately 1 teaspoon. Anything in excess of 4 grams of glucose needs to be removed from the circulation, and does that have potential harmful effects? And so then what happens within the tissues when that glucose level becomes elevated? And I'm going to cover the mechanism of action of that damage and describe both direct and indirect mechanisms. And then we're going to look briefly at other damage that is documented with carbohydrate excess. And if I'm going to demonize carbohydrate, then we need to carefully consider alternative fuel sources, such as ketones, and see if they're actually safe. And then I'm specifically going to present the case of that safety in relationship to pregnancy and infant growth, the most important times when nutrition is critical for outcome. So back to our understanding of carbohydrate. There are only effectively 2 molecules in carbohydrate. Complex carbohydrates are those repeating chains. And despite having very similar structures, glucose and fructose have quite different metabolic pathways. And the definitive description of fructose metabolism was only as recently as 2010. So carbohydrate comes in a variety of sources and a variety of names. But in the pre-agricultural revolution, the natural sources were seasonal fresh fruit and honey, a small amount of glycogen in meat, and breast milk. So from an evolutionary aspect, these would have been our only effective sources of carbohydrate intake. Now, some of you heard me speak to this before, but carbohydrate, amino acids from protein, and fatty acids from fat are the fuels we can utilize in our cells. The mitochondria convert those fuels into adenosine triphosphate, ATP, and then that ATP is then utilized as an energy source throughout the body. Basic physiology describes how the Krebs cycle converts acetyl-CoA into ATP. The acetyl-CoA can be effectively sourced from either glucose, fatty acids, or amino acids from proteins. There are essential fats and essential proteins that are required in the diet, but there are no essential carbohydrates that are required for mitochondrial function. Mother Nature has not made us dependent on one seasonally available carbohydrate. Well, that's science. Inside the mitochondria, it's about science, and outside of the cell, food has become about politics, money, and emotion. That's non-science, and that non-science has been extensively covered in some of my previous talks and Belinda Fedke's presentations. So There's a lot of misinformation on what is our actual glucose requirement. There are very few cells that only require glucose as their energy source. Those cells do not have mitochondria. Red blood cells and some cells in the lens of the eye and the thin cells in the loop of Henle in the kidney require glucose as their energy substrate. The small amount of glucose does not need to be eaten. So despite misconceptions, the brain is not dependent on glucose as its only fuel source. The brain has mitochondria and will manage very well on a combination of lactate, ketones and glucose sourced from gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis gives us enough glucose for that cell activity and does not give us hyperglycemia. The body does not chronically overproduce glucose. So glucose can either be eaten or created from the breakdown of stored glycogen, glycerol and triglycerides or via protein conversion in gluconeogenesis. That created glucose is for metabolic need and is not produced for excess. That is left to our ingested consumption. So when we eat it, glucose is absorbed from the gut and then distributed around the body under the direct effect of insulin. The excess glucose requires immediate removal from the circulation. When those processes fail, we have diabetes. Insulin is the major hormone moving glucose out of the bloodstream and into the tissues. A chronic excess glucose load results in hyperinsulinemia, and there are detrimental effects of a chronically elevated insulin secretion. So how much glucose do we need to ingest before we trigger an elevation in the blood glucose and therefore trigger that insulin response? Well, that amount is around 4 grams or that 1 teaspoon. To put that in perspective, one slice of bread contains around 5 teaspoons of glucose. The immediate metabolic requirement is for around 1 of those. The other 4 teaspoons need to be taken out of the bloodstream under the direct influence of insulin. Otherwise, the blood glucose level goes up, particularly in those with diabetes. When blood glucose rises, there follows an elevation of glucose in the interstitial fluid as well as all tissues. There are mechanistic issues in causing damage, which can either be direct or indirect. So let's look at hyperglycemia. It is a clinical issue of too high a blood glucose. The complications of that elevated glucose can be acute or chronic. A prolonged elevation of blood glucose manifests as diabetes. Acute complications include agitation, fatigue, thirst, and increased urine output. And I recognise that this is not going to occur with one slice of bread, but it is indicative of the issues related to an elevated blood glucose. And in extreme situations, hyperosmolar syndrome for type 2s and ketoacidosis for type 1s. These people are generally ill from other problems, and neither of these states are nutritional ketosis. Nutritional ketosis is a perfectly normal metabolic state that we can drift in and out of when you skip meals or fast. So what are the chronic complications of your blood glucose being too high? Organ damage is significantly caused by advanced glycation end products known as AGEs. The damage over time is directly related to chronic disease, organ failure, and ultimately death. So how do advanced glycation end products cause damage? We've all seen the browning of toast, cakes, and biscuits. That's called the Maillard reaction. Glucose binds to protein, and under the effect of heat, the slice of bread goes brown. The same thing happens in your tissue. High glucose levels combine with the protein, and under body heat, the Maillard reaction takes place. That reaction makes tissue stiffer and inflamed. So every time your blood glucose spikes up, you are effectively toasting your brain, your eyes, your kidneys, your vessels. This toasting is occurring in every organ of your body every day with an elevated blood glucose. Welcome to the complications of poorly controlled elevated blood glucose. Oxidation affects not just proteins, but also glucose and lipids. And once oxidized, these molecules become part of the overall inflammatory process. There's also the polyol pathway conversion of glucose to fructose, releasing inflammatory oxygen-free radicals along the way. And they have the same effect as advanced glycation end products. We can measure the effect of AGEs in the blood, and the common test for diabetes control is the HbA1c. It is a measure of the damage done by those AGEs on erythrocytes and measures that effect over approximately the previous 3 months. The higher the percentage, the greater the damage. So what do those advanced glycation end products do? Well, they account for organ damage at a tissue level, at every tissue level. They can affect the brain, causing issues from dementia, now being considered as type 3 diabetes, through to mental health and strokes. It is a mechanism causing diabetic retinopathy and macular degeneration in the eyes. Peripheral vascular disease, heart attacks, kidney failure, peripheral neuropathy, foot ulceration and amputation, wound healing and the infection in all of its forms, and cancer. End organ damage is what kills you. Slowly we die from the excess glucose in our blood and tissue. An elevated glucose level creates damage in all tissues by a combination of ages as well as glycation of tissue proteins and fat. The protein damage is not just to structural proteins, but also to messenger protein, the very backbone of our DNA. However, what happens to the largest organ of the body? Many of you may be surprised to realize that it is not the skin, and it is in fact our glycocalyx. The glycocalyx lines all blood vessels and has a surface area of 4,000 to 7,000 square meters and a volume of approximately 1,700 mils. It is metabolically active and produces nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is a potent vasodilator that is critical to control blood pressure as well as microcirculation at the capillary level. The glycocalyx is the gateway layer in transportation of nutrients and chemicals across blood vessel walls. It is a complex lining of every blood vessel made up of a combination of carbohydrate and protein in the form of glycoproteins, polysaccharides, proteoglycans, and glycosaminoglycans, thereby rendering the entire layer susceptible to changes in blood glucose. The glycocalyx is probably one of the least understood areas of the body, yet critical to our homeostasis. Pellinger and Cam's 2017 review of the endothelial glycocalyx gives an excellent overview, including the damaging effect of diabetes. The glycocalyx is fragile, and most modern lifestyle and environmental factors are likely to damage it, in particular carbohydrates and their metabolites. Some of these factors overlap, but have all been documented in the literature. The damaged glycocalyx results in an increase in vessel permeability of all substances. When the glycocalyx is damaged, it not only loses its ability to produce nitric oxide, but the damaged layer creates an increased permeability of blood vessel walls. This is a similar concept to what we understand as leaky gut in the intestine. The breakdown of tight junctions increases susceptibility to toxic material crossing from the gut into the bloodstream. The loss of glycocalyx layer allows material to move out of the blood into the tissues in an uncontrolled fashion, thereby rendering every corner of the body susceptible. Glycocalyx recovery from an acute glucose load can take hours to recover. Some studies claim that the recovery time frame may be 5 to 7 days. Diabetics with chronic hyperglycemia have an average 50% reduction in glycocalyx thickness and resulting increased permeability and thrombosis potential. The glycocalyx damage is greater with poorer control of blood glucose, as evident in the type 1 diabetes population. The poorer circulatory flow and increased permeability place those with diabetes at much higher risk of cardiovascular compromise and organ failure. So, after considering the direct effects of an elevated blood glucose, there is the added indirect effect on the whole body as a result of elevated insulin secretion. Now, we know insulin has multiple benefits to us from an evolutionary standpoint, and particularly in its use as a fat storage hormone. But modern society now has such a plentiful supply of food, and the evolutionary benefit of insulin is no longer required, that chronic elevated secretion of insulin comes with an entire set of problems. Insulin is secreted when we have an excessive carbohydrate intake, and as said earlier, primarily stores that excess as fat. But insulin is also a tumor growth hormone and probably the most influential one. The hyperinsulinemia state is associated with higher rates of cancer and poorer outcome. A lesser known effect of insulin is that it is an inflammatory hormone as well. Recent 2020 literature has shown insulin to have a dose-related effect on synoviocytes in the knee. These are the cells lining the knee joint and primary cells responsible for inflammation. reducing insulin load to these knee cells reduced inflammation, increased insulin, increased inflammation. Now, I know that paper wasn't written by a low-carber, as they concluded that insulin should be targeted with intervention, completely missing the point that the lowest levels of insulin secretion are related to low-carb dietary intake. The insulin effect gives a background mechanism to those patients with osteoarthritis having a symptom reduction when adopting a lower carbohydrate intake well before they lose significant weight. I see that benefit every week in my patients. Insulin also depletes magnesium, which is required in multiple biochemical pathways, and higher levels of insulin reduce vitamin D activity. And that overall increases the prothrombotic state with a higher risk of deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary embolism. Glucose has direct and indirect effects on the tissues. Fructose has its own. Once again, it has both direct and indirect effects, particularly in the non-physiological state, as we are no longer hunter-gatherers. The following is a brief overview of fructose metabolism and its effects. Further information on my talks on inflammation cover this in more detail. So fructose is similar to glucose, but metabolized quite differently. It is mostly metabolized in the liver on a first-pass basis. A small amount is metabolized in the gut and the mesentery. The absorption and metabolism can be upregulated depending on intake, and this suited us as hunter-gatherers when increasing our fruit intake when it was seasonally available. From an evolutionary aspect, fruit is generally in excess at times of plenty to be stored away as fat for winter hibernation. The major issue now is the oversupply and daily availability of fructose. So fructose, a small amount is metabolized to glycogen storage. A significant amount travels via the aldehyde pathway, which is effectively turning the fructose into alcohol, and that has damaging local effects within the liver. One of the byproducts of fructose metabolism is uric acid. And when fructose is consumed in excess, then we have an increase in production of uric acid, which manifests itself as gout. This is obvious when it precipitates into the foot, but low levels of elevated uric acid are likely to be playing a role in a range of inflammatory tissue conditions. The other major effect of uric acid is on nitric oxide production. This is separate from the direct damaging glucose effect on the glycocalyx in the blood vessel walls that was referred to earlier. There are three forms of nitric oxide, and they are all affected by uric acid. Uric acid inhibits nitric oxidase, resulting in a reduced availability of nitric oxide throughout the body. The three forms of nitric oxide are neuronal, which maintains the brain blood supply. There's the endothelial nitric oxide produced by the glycocalyx acting as a vasodilator and effectively controlling our blood pressure and microcirculation. The inducible form is integral to our immune function and effectively allows white cell mobility. Again, uric acid inhibits the production of all three forms. The increased production inhibits nitric oxide availability of the brain with a reduction in brain blood supplies. It has implications in dementia and mental health. When we lose the vasodilatory effect, hypertension follows, and we regularly see an improvement in blood pressure control with a reduction of sugar in the lifestyle, once again before an associated weight loss. Uric acid reduces white cell function and is associated with poorer immunity and higher infection rates. There is a central role of considering nitric oxide in cancer management. Fructose is involved in the development of insulin resistance in muscle and the liver, and this compounds the hyperinsulinemia seen with prolonged exposure to excess glucose consumption. Fructose is involved in the development of leptin resistance at the hypothalamus, affecting appetite. Again, this is beneficial from an evolutionary aspect for fat storage, but not in our current food availability state. Leptin is normally secreted from fat when there is plenty on board. It normally acts as an appetite suppressant, but when inhibited, contributes to the hunger and food addiction. Fructose also stimulates ghrelin secretion, which makes your tummy rumble, also contributing to the hunger sensation. All useful in evolution, but not in our current obesity issues. Fructose is ultimately metabolized and transported as a small, dense lipoprotein, which is prone to oxidation. These oxidized particles are implicated in cardiovascular disease and inflammation. An excess intake of fructose is associated with a significant increase in small, dense LDL production. The greater the intake, the higher the small dense LDL production there is. And once oxidized, becomes the cardiovascular catastrophe, which is being played out in society right now. Previously described in my inflammation talks, there is a polyol pathway that converts up to 30% of ingested carbohydrate into fructose. This only compounds the direct harm issues related to excess glucose as well as fructose consumption. There are other harmful issues associated with carbohydrate intake. As far back as 1973, it was documented that consumption of sugar and glucose was associated with a reduction of immune function. This reduction was measured as a phagocytic index. It was a measure of how effective white cell neutrophils consume bacteria. A reduction in immune function was observed for 5 hours after eating carbohydrates. This paper alone raised my concern about post-surgical food and why do we give patients sandwiches, fruit juice and cookies immediately after surgery when this has a clear detrimental outcome on our immunity. An interesting side note to that study was that the phagocytic index continued to improve the longer the subjects fasted. The ketotic state that would have been achieved by 60 hours appears to have been beneficial on our immunity. Unfortunately, post-operative fasting for 2.5 days after surgery is unlikely to be enthusiastically embraced by my patients. So this detrimental effect of glucose on phagocytosis has been reproduced in other papers. It's almost as though this basic physiology of our immune function has been ignored for decades. Elevated blood glucose is well documented to create poorer function across most blood cells, which affect immunity and clotting states. Small glucose loads can increase erythrocyte aggregation within minutes, which is part of a prothrombotic state. Osteoarthritis is now seen to be an inflammatory condition rather than purely a wear scenario. Advanced glycation end products appear to be the damaging molecule of articular cartilage. That combination of ages and oxygen-free radical formation contribute to articular cartilage damage. This is exacerbated by the inflammatory effect of insulin, as discussed earlier. At the cartilage level, we see the byproducts of carbohydrate metabolism causing harm. We do not see the byproducts of protein and fat metabolism. I was discussing this with an orthopedic colleague who has an interest in ancient skeletons. Pre-agricultural revolution skeletons do not have the osteoarthritis picture that we currently see. Is that because of their reduced carbohydrate and inflammatory lifestyle? Likewise, those same byproducts of carbohydrate metabolism are present within degenerate tendons. What was once thought to be a wear and tear issue of tendons turns out to be an inflammatory problem, secondary to the same ages and oxygen-free radical production that is occurring in joint cartilage. I looked through the literature to see if the same process was occurring in the discs of the spine, and that has not been documented. The harmful effects of carbohydrate appear to be localized to the cartilage and the tendons rather than the spine. Across all specialties, there are higher rates of postoperative infection associated with perioperative hyperglycemia. So to truly consider if carbohydrate in excess is toxic, one needs to look at the literature to see if the removal of the toxic substance results in improved outcome. And removal of glucose loads is documented to improve glycocalyx thickness and function within hours to days. The removal of fructose in an isocaloric fashion results in improvement in non-alcoholic fatty liver disease within days. Lower carbohydrate lifestyle changes are documented in multiple randomly controlled trials to be the most effective method in improving weight loss and diabetes control. The significant reduction of glucose, certainly in excess, is the central factor in the majority of studies. Lowering carbohydrate intake improves cardiovascular risk profiles across multiple markers. So I've made the case of toxicity of carbohydrate and the lengths that the body will go to remove it from the circulation. We evolved over a couple of million years without substantial carbohydrate in our diet and therefore sourced our energy requirements from protein and fats. So after demonizing carbohydrates, then I need to prove that the other option of fueling the body in the form of ketones is actually safe. So what evidence do we have that a diet higher in fat intake resulting in nutritional ketosis is not only safe but likely beneficial? So to prove the safety of an intervention, ideally we should have human trials. There should be large numbers involved in those trials. There should be firm endpoints to study. And we should be able to control timeframes in those study populations. there should be good follow-up data. The results should be reproducible, and ideally multi-centre trials reaching the same conclusion. The results should be published in peer-reviewed literature and be applicable across international boundaries. We may already have all of that literature at hand. In the last few years, I've given that some thought, particularly in the view of becoming a grandparent once again. Our elder daughter struggled with morning sickness for several months and was in a state of continued ketosis, not just by choice, but by situation. It made me look at the literature relating to that state of constant ketosis and the results in pregnancy. The fetus, babies and young children grow in a state of ketosis. Our most important development period demands a state of ketosis. And I'll quote Angela Stanton, who's done some extraordinary work in this area, putting together some of the papers that I struggled to find, and it is worth looking at her work. So our most important development period is dependent on a state of ketosis. Newborns and infants spend significant amounts of time in ketosis and take very short periods of time to drift into that state. Ketosis is a normal state in fasting pregnancy, for newborns, in infants, and children through to 4 years of age. All stages utilize ketones as a fuel source, and it is clearly the safe mode for the human body, and we appear to thrive in that situation. Growth is in fact dependent upon it. So pregnancy is clearly a critical period for embryonic and neonatal development. Maternal nutrition is obviously central, and the literature abounds with pregnancy-related outcomes, which leads me to consider the case of morning sickness, otherwise known as nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. Severe morning sickness, generally occurring in the first trimester, is quite common. If the mother doesn't eat, then she clearly moves into a state of ketosis. The more severe the morning sickness, the greater the state of ketosis and the longer the periods of time within it. This makes for an interesting group of women to study the outcomes of the pregnancy. The opposite end of the spectrum is that of gestational diabetes, which is also common. It is a state of both maternal and placental elevated glucose. Multiple endpoints are well documented in the literature for both severe nausea and vomiting of pregnancy, as well as gestational diabetes. So I've combined multiple studies in my literature study, and there were consistent findings. The literature strongly supports the following. Those women with significant morning sickness and likely state of ketosis bear children with a lower rate of birth defects. They have a lower miscarriage rate and their pregnancies normally go through to full-term confinement. Their birth weights are generally maintained and they have low complications of the overall pregnancy. Early childhood development in both cognition and health appears to be advanced. In contrast, those women with gestational diabetes have higher rates of children with birth defects, and those defects tend to be environmental rather than genetic. They are more likely to miscarriage and are less likely to get through to full-time confinement. They are more likely to have very high and very low birth weight babies and are prone to significantly more complications through the pregnancy. And early childhood development, both from the cognition and health aspect, are poorer in comparison with those babies of women without gestational diabetes. There is a significant difference between the babies affected by ketosis in comparison with diabetes. Clearly, the state of ketosis is not harmful. So what can we conclude from this? The state of ketosis is required in critical development phases of life. If the state of ketosis is safe for the fetus and our babies, then it is clearly safe for children and adults. Is the benefit from a state of low glucose or one of low in insulin, or in fact both? Does the benefit come from a low glucose state or an increased ketone environment? My interpretation is that both are contributing. Again, my interpretation of literature is that a diet low in carbohydrates and higher in healthy fats is the optimal diet, not just for neonates and infants, but for all of life. Carbohydrates are common in our diets, but our body does not treat them kindly. Both glucose and fructose are moved out of the bloodstream as soon as practical because of their toxic effects. There is no single biochemical pathway that is dependent on ingested carbohydrate. The biochemistry is simple. More than one teaspoon is treated by the body as toxic. The fetus, babies and young children grow in a state of ketosis. and most important development period requires a state of ketosis. The safe operating mode of our body is one of nutritional ketosis. The state of fasting and avoidance of carbohydrate in particular stimulates our immune system towards better health. So with the onset of the agricultural revolution around 10,000 years ago, we started to see the onset of modern disease. That has only compounded in the last 100 years with the increased intake of processed food and the significant carbohydrate component of that. Carbohydrate becomes toxic when it begins to have a negative influence on our body. It all comes down to biochemistry. And that dose appears to be just 1 teaspoon. So hopefully that has left you with some food for thought. Thank you all. Look forward to catching up with you all once again.
Okay, so that was Dr. Gary Fitke. And that was an excellent talk, really excellent summation of really why excess carbohydrates are damaging. They're dangerous, they're damaging, and you know, he just kind of calmly went through the whole thing, and I mean, he really summed it up well. So if you listen through that, that's really worth listening to, and you've been exposed to it. So, you know, that's just, I don't know, some people could probably listen to that and still go ahead and just, you know, eat their carbohydrates, you know, and it's just, but it's not, you know, and like he said, he was saying, you know, you know the fructose is especially damaging. You know, of course, table sugar is 1/2 fructose. Fruit contains a lot of fructose. People think, oh, bananas are healthy, or, you know, fruit's healthy, you know, and that's just been repeated over and over again, and it's full of fructose. So, not so healthy, especially modern fruit, because it's been, you know, some people call it frankenfruit, because it's been, you know, modified by crossbreeding, God knows whatever else, to the point where, you know, we got these, you know, this giant super sweet fruit. That's certainly true of the bananas. That we, you know, the thing that we think of as modern bananas, you know, you go back, you know, a number of, you know, 100, 200 years, and those didn't exist. The thing that they developed modern bananas from wasn't very sweet, and it was small, and it was full of seeds, you know, and so, but. You know, and then, like he said, a slice of bread's got like the equivalent of 5 teaspoons of sugar in it. So, you know, we exist our, you know, in modern lives, you know, we've eaten all these carbohydrates, and of course the body is really great at compensating. It compensates in, you know, probably, you know, ways we haven't even figured out yet. And damage is occurring. You know, the entire time damage is occurring. And, you know, it's really, really eye-opening. If you really listen to that and understand what he's talking about, you know, I will not go back. I've seen the benefits personally of cutting out, you know, I cut out pasta, potatoes, rice, and bread, and I've seen tremendous benefit from it. You know, like I've said many times, I'm sure people are tired of me saying it, but, you know, I've been doing it now for 3 years. The first year, I kind of gradually lost about 35 to 40 pounds, and then since then, my weight just stays at 150, or right around 150. Sometimes it's a little less than that, sometimes it's just, you know, maybe a pound or so above that, but it's really consistent. And, you know, and what's And prior to that, my weight was always trying to creep up. At one time, I got all the way up to 225. That was back in the early 2000s. And, of course, I was eating all kinds of cakes and cookies and candies because it was present in the workplace. I've really got good control of it now, and once in a great while I'll eat a small piece of a dessert or whatever, but that's maybe once a year or maybe every 6 months, but it's pretty rare that I even consider anything like that. But my diet now is basically any kind of meat, lots of salad, and most vegetables. And I seem to be doing really well on it. Well, I know I am. You know, it's not seem to be. So, but anyway, I thought I would play that. And, he made a pretty good argument, and he admitted his bias right up front, of course, but he just kind of matter-of-factly went through it. And, I think sometimes if you just kind of matter-of-factly, if someone can matter-of-factly just kind of work their way through something like that, of course it was fairly densely packed with the facts, it's kind of hard to argue against, really. And of course, the problem is people can be presented with facts, and if you're ideologically possessed, then you can ignore the facts. Facts are easily ignored. You know, that people just don't see them. So, but anyway, probably better be cutting this off. By the way, I'll put the link to the video in the show notes for this podcast. So if you go to TruckerTomPodcast.com for this particular podcast, I'll embed the video in the show notes so you can actually watch his presentation, because he's giving it, it's like a PowerPoint thing, and he's got their slides with each one of the points that he's making in the video, and it's worth watching. I've already kind of listened through it a couple. This makes the second time I've actually listened through it, and I'll probably make a point of watching the slides at some point, because. But it's really good information. So, anyway, hope everyone is having a great week, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.